Lulu, when she moved to Atlanta to be with Jane, where they live now, she said that in Atlanta, the biggest racism that she got was from light-skinned blacks rather than from whites. And I was just wondering what your thoughts would be about what Martin Luther King and or Malcolm X would say about Obama.
They both were light-skinned blacks.
Pardon?
They both were light-skinned blacks, and they love black people. That's just a mythology. I'm from the South, and there is a long and strong tradition of passing and of education and of people being many shades of black, and I certainly could not accept that as a generalism. This is Earthwatch, and you're on the air. We're going fast because we're almost out of time.
Hello?
No offense. Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, Al Jazeera gets promoted on WBAI all the time.
Well, yes, there was an agreement between Pacifica and Al Jazeera that made some sense in that it was, at the time, an outlet for primary voices of the Arabic and Muslim world that were not heard, by and large, on American broadcast. And I think that part of it is a good thing. Every issue is complex. And, I support the xenophiliac impulse of bringing in voices of cultures that are traditionally unheard. That part of it is consistent with the Pacifica mission. But as a news editor, producer, journalist, investigator, and award winner, I do reserve the right to challenge the credibility of a royal news agency supporting and concealing the clandestine operations of its own military in the takeover of a nation that results in the tragedy and racism that we're seeing today. I actually, on 5 o'clock shadow, addressed this very issue with our executive director, Arlene Engelhardt, who answered honorably. So I do not want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, if you catch my drift. But as a journalist, news and investigative producer, I certainly reserve the right to challenge the credibility of an institution on matters of national interest and coverage neglect. I was going to say concealment, but let me be kind and say simply neglect. And that is the beauty of the complexity of Pacifica and of WBAI. That we can have these paradoxes and the beautiful freedom of accumulation of choruses of discord and harmony that characterize a once and future great institution that is moving forward. And I'm glad that you're part of it. And that you all let me play here, too. That concludes tonight's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight. And coming up will be Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund, with really smart stuff of space, science, fiction, fantasy, imagination, wit. And so I hope you'll stay tuned for that and join us next week when we're going to be talking about the decline of the United States and other nations in the local environment, and by that I mean the realm of outer space.
Bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pass magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange
on Friday, September 9th.
My apologies. I was trying to segue to something very specific, and our system here was I wanted to play a specific promo, and instead it played a promo of its choosing. Let me try that one more time by hitting the play button. Pretend that you're hearing Strange Fruit and that it goes to this.
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes. Wednesday, 9:12:01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street and LaGuardia Place.
On Sunday, September 11th, as part of WBAI's special anniversary programming, the next hour, with guest host Jim Freund, will feature this award-winning story, followed by an interview with Rick Bowes and the preeminent psychologist on contemporary terrorism, Dr. Charles B. Strozier. That's September 11th at 11 a.m. on the next hour, featuring Richard Bowes reading There's a Hole in the City.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, we're going to be moving time in many wibbly-wobbly kinds. kinds of ways. Some Heinlein and some who. Stay tuned. Oh yes, Terrence Taylor will be on the phone. Once again, good morning. Okay, so this is, like last week, somewhat a free-form show, except for the fact that I semi-planned it just before coming in, thinking about what to do. As recently as 11 p.m., I came up with a couple of things. Last week was a tribute, an introduction to one of my favorite writers, Cord Wiener Smith. And I thought, just because I came across a certain song that would work well, and because it involved crazy time travel, I thought, why not a classic Heinlein story? One that, well, if you've been watching Doctor Who at all, fits right in. So right now, I am going to issue a warning. One second. And that warning is, yeah, by all means, stick with me. I'm queuing up that song, so I don't screw it up later. And I'm expecting troubles, and indeed, it's giving them to me. Ah, okay, got it. Thank you. I believe it's there and ready to play. Yes, good. So, the warning is, yes, yeah, stick with me definitely for the Heinlein. But after the Heinlein, I'm going to call frequent guest and wonderful writer Terrence Taylor and fellow Whovian. I was offering this to Amy Goldschlager, but she may have to work tomorrow. And finishing a show that ends at 3 a.m. doesn't easily loan oneself to that. So, here's the warning. If you are not up to date on Doctor Who, A, you'll be confused. B, spoilers. That's all. It's all spoilers. So if you're into it, stay tuned. If you're not, after the story, either tune out or be confused or even be disappointed. Before I read the story, I will say, oh, and you know what? Because I'm reading a story, it's one of those few occasions where I'm actually going to close the door to the control room. I know Robert's going to be coming in, but that's okay. He understands. But other people, you know, sound leaks from outside, close the door. I'm better off when I'm doing a reading actually being in a slightly insulated room. Okay? So, talking with Amy. Amy is the guest curator of the next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which this year will not be the first Tuesday of the month, as it usually is, but will instead be the second Tuesday, avoiding Labor Day and issues like that. So, what date is that? Is it the, I think it's September 13th, if I do this thing here on a normal Windows machine. Okay. I know, well, no, multi-minute, yeah. Doesn't give me the calendar offhand. It's probably the 13th. It's the second Tuesday, okay? At 138 Sullivan Street, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, and our readers will be Chris Claremont and Louise Simonson. It will be a marvel. I promise you, it will be a marvel. Both people worked on X-Men and many, many of the titles that Marvel had through the years. Louise worked on X-Factor, New Mutants, Superman, the Man of Steel. According to Wikipedia, she is often referred to by the nickname Wheezy. Well, despite that, she is also a prose writer. And Chris Claremont has several novels under his belt, three of which he co-wrote with some guy named George Lucas. And, in fact, first time I met Chris was when a novel of his, First Flight, had come out, in the Nicol Shea trilogy. And he's back, by the way, to writing prose. So both will be reading for us. These may be giants in the comic book industry, but they are here as prose readers. So more information on that next week. If you want to know more, send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com. Hi, Robert. I close the door because I'm going to be reading in a while. It's actually a good thing. It's despite the fact that it's Heinlein. Why is it that all these
I know I'm not
radicals,
supposed to, but I kind of like him.
Good. That's what I was about to say. I mean, the biggest defender of Heinlein I knew was Manya La Bruja.
Starship Troopers.
Okay, well, Starship Troopers was, in its day, a major, major, broke racial barriers.
Mm-hmm.
For those who, for all of its jingo.
It was special,
but what it was is that you have this lead character, and you only find out of 180 pages, you only find out about 120 pages in that the lead character is Puerto Rican.
Oh, man, Shades of Dahlgren.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, Robert. But that was, that was actually a first. Heinlein had a lot of problems. That was
book
not one of
cover.
Them. Yeah. Yeah, book cover. Can't tell it by what ever. Earthwatch next week at midnight, 5 o'clock shadow, every day at, 5 o'clock. Hour of the Wolf, 1:30 to 3, and I better get going. I should look up. I should tell you what year this story was published, but I'll do that later. Let's get going. But suffice it to say, this is an old story, probably from the 40s. That's the 1940s. Nevertheless, the dateline on the story is 2217, All You Zombies, by Robert Anson Heinlein. Time Zone 5, EST, 7 November, 1970. I should mention that makes this story in the far future. 1970, NTC, Pop's Place. Okay, I was polishing a brandy snifter when the unmarried mother came in. I noted the time, 10:17 p.m., Zone 5, or Eastern Time, November 7th, 1970. Temporal agents always notice time and date. We must. The unmarried mother was a man, 25 years old, no taller than I am, childish features and a touchy temper. I didn't like his looks. I never had, but he was a lad when I was here to recruit. He was my boy. I gave him my best barkeep smile. Maybe I'm too critical. He wasn't weird. His nickname came from what he always said when some nosy type asked him his line, I'm an unmarried mother. If he felt less than murderous, he would add, at 4 cents a word, I write confession stories. If he felt nasty, he would wait for somebody to make something of it. He had a lethal style of infighting, like a female cop. Reason I wanted him. Not the only one. He had a load on. His face showed that he despised people more than usual. Silently, I poured a double shot of old underwear and left the bottle. He drank it, poured another. I wiped the bar top. So, how's the unmarried mother racket? His fingers tightened on the glass, and he seemed about to throw it at me. I felt for the sap under the bar. In temporal manipulation, you try to figure everything, but there are so many factors that you never take needless risks. I saw him relax that tiny amount they teach you to watch for in the Bureau's training school. "Sorry," I said. "Just asking, how's business? Make it, how's the weather?" He looked sour. "Business is okay. I write 'em, they print 'em, I eat." I poured myself one, leaned toward him. "Matter of fact," I said, "you write a nice stick. I've sampled a few. You have an amazingly sure touch of the woman's angle." Now, this was a slip I had to risk. He never admitted what pen names he used, but he was boiled enough to pick up only the last "woman's angle," he repeated with a snort. "Yeah, I know the woman's angle. I should." "So," I said doubtfully, "sisters?" "Now, you wouldn't believe me if I told you." "Now, now," I answered mildly. "Bartenders and psychiatrists learn that nothing is stranger than truth. Why, son, if you heard the stories I do, well, you'd make yourself rich." "Incredible." "You don't know what incredible means." "So, nothing astonishes me. I've always heard worse." He snorted again. "You want to bet the rest of the bottle?" "I'll bet a full bottle." I placed one on the bar. "Well," I signaled my other bartender to handle the trade. We were at the far end, a single stool space that I kept private by loading the bar top by it with the jars of pickled eggs and other clutter. A few were at the other end watching the fights, and somebody else was playing the jukebox, private as a bed where we were. "Okay, to start with, I'm a bastard." "Yeah, that's no distinction around here," I said. "No, I mean it. My parents weren't married." "Yeah, still no distinction. Neither were mine. When—" He stopped, giving me the first warm look I ever saw on him. "You mean that?" "Yeah, of course I do. 100% bastard. In fact, no one in my family ever marries. All bastards." "Now that," I showed it to him. "It just looks like a wedding ring. I wear it to keep women off. It's an antique I bought in 1985 from a fellow operative. He had fetched it from pre-Christian Crete. The worm Ouroboros, the world snake that eats its own tail, forever without end, a symbol of the great paradox." He barely glanced at it. "If you're really a bastard, you know how it feels." "Listen, when I was a little girl—" Whoa, I said. "Did I hear you correctly?" "Look, who's telling this story? When I was a little girl—" "Look, have you ever heard of Christine Jorgensen or Roberta Cowell?" You mean the sex change cases? You're trying to tell me—" "Don't interrupt or swelp me. I won't talk. I was a foundling, left at an orphanage in Cleveland in 1945 when I was a month old. When I was a little girl, I envied kids with parents. And then when I learned about sex, and believe me, Pop, you learn fast in an orphanage." "Yeah, I know." "I made a solemn vow that any kid of mine would have both a pop and a mom. It kept me pure. Quite a feat in that vicinity. I had to learn to fight to manage it. Then I got older and realized that I stood darn little chance of getting married for the same reason I hadn't been adopted." He scowled. I was horse-faced and buck-toothed, flat-chested and straight-haired." "You don't look any worse than I do. Who cares how a barkeep looks? Or a writer. But people wanting to adopt pick little blue-eyed, golden-haired morons. Later on, the boys want bulging breasts, a cute face, and an, oh, you wonderful male manner." He shrugged. "I couldn't compete, so I decided to join the wenches." "Excuse me? The Women's Emergency National Corps Hospitality and Entertainment Section. What they now call the Space Angels, Auxiliary Nursing Group, Extraterrestrial Legions." "Yeah, I knew both terms once I had them chronized. We use still a third name. It's that Elite Service Corps, Women's Hospitality Order Reortifying and Encouraging Spacemen." "Yep. Vocabulary shift is the worst hurdle in time jumps. Did you know that a service station once served oil fractions? Once on an assignment in the Churchill era, a woman said to me, 'Meet me at the service station next door,' which is not what it sounds like. A service station in those days wouldn't have a bed on it." Well, he went on. It was when they first admitted me. You can't send men into space for months and years and not relieve the tension. You remember how the wowzers screamed? That improved my chance since volunteers were scarce. A gal had to be respectable, preferably virgin. They like to train them from scratch, above average mentally and stable emotionally. But most volunteers were old hookers or neurotics who would crack up 10 days off Earth. So I didn't need looks. If they accepted me, they would fix my buck teeth, put a wave in my hair, teach me to walk and dance and how to listen to a man pleasingly and everything else, plus training for prime duties. They would even use plastic surgery if it would help. Nothing is too good for our boys. And best of all, they made sure you didn't get pregnant during your enlistment, and you were almost certain to marry at the end of your hitch. Same way today, angels, A-N-G-E-L-S, they marry spacers. They talk the language. When I was 18, I was placed as a mother's helper. This family simply wanted a cheap servant, but I didn't mind as I couldn't enlist till I was 21. I did housework and went to night school, pretending to continue my high school typing in shorthand, but going to a charm class instead to better my chances for enlistment. So I met the city slicker with his $100 bills, he scowled. The no-good actually did have a wad of $100 bills. He showed me one night, told me to help myself. But I didn't. I liked him. He was the first man I ever met who was nice to me without trying games with me. I quit night school to see him oftener. It was the happiest time of my life. And then one night in the park, the games began. He stopped. I said, yeah, and then? And then nothing. Nothing. I never saw him again. He walked me home, told me he loved me, and kissed me goodnight, and he never came back. If I could find him, I'd kill him. Well, I sympathize. I know just how you feel. But killing him just for doing what comes naturally, I mean, did you struggle? Huh? Well, what's that got to do with it? Well, actually, quite a bit. Maybe he deserves a couple of broken arms for running out on you. But no, he deserves worse than that. Wait till you hear. Somehow, I kept anyone from suspecting and decided it was all for the West. I hadn't really loved him and probably would never love anybody, and I was more than eager to join the wenches. I wasn't disqualified. They didn't insist on virgins. I cheered up. And it wasn't until my skirts got tight that I realized. Pregnant? Oh, he had me higher than a kite. Those skinflints I lived with ignored it as long as I could work and kicked me out in the orphanage wouldn't take me back. I landed in a charity ward surrounded by some other big bellies and shrouded bedpans until my time came. One night I found myself in an operating table with a nurse saying, relax, now breathe. I woke up in bed, numb from the chest down. My surgeon comes in. How do you feel? He says cheerfully. Like a mummy, says I. Yeah, naturally. You're wrapped like one and full of dope to keep you numb. You'll get well. But a cesarean isn't a hangnail. Cesarean, says I. Doc, did I lose the baby? Oh, no, your baby is fine. Boy or a girl? It's a healthy little girl, 5 pounds, 3 ounces. I relax. It's something to have made a baby. I told myself I'd go somewhere, tack Mrs. on my name, let the kid think her papa was dead. No orphanage for my kid. But the surgeon was talking. Tell me, he avoided my name. Did you ever think your glandular setup was odd? I said, huh? Of course not. What are you driving at? He hesitated. I'll give you this in one dose. Then a hypo to let you sleep off your jitters. You'll have them. Yeah, why? I demanded. Ever hear of that Scottish physician who was female until she was 35, then had surgery and became legally and medically a man, got married, all okay? Yeah, well, what's that got to do with me? Well, that's what I'm saying. You're a man. I tried to sit up. What? Take it easy, take it easy. When I opened you, I found a mess. I sent for the chief of surgery while I got the baby out. Then we held a consultation with you on the table and worked for hours to salvage what we could. You had 2 full sets of organs, both immature, but with the female set well enough developed for you to have a baby. They could never be any use to you again, so we took them out and rearranged things so that you can now properly develop as a man. Don't worry. You're young. Your bones will readjust. We'll watch your glandular balance and we'll make a fine young man out of you. So I started to cry. What about my baby? Well, you can't nurse her. You don't have milk enough for a kitten. If I were you, I wouldn't see her. I'd just put her up for adoption. No! Well, he shrugged. The choice is yours. You're her mother. At least you're her parent. But don't worry now. We'll get you well first. So the next day, they let me see the kitten. I saw her daily, trying to get used to her. I'd never seen a brand new baby before. I had no idea how awful they look. My daughter looked like an orange monkey. My feelings changed to cold determination to do right by her. But 4 weeks later, that didn't mean anything. Huh? She was snatched. Snatched? The unmarried mother almost knocked over the bottle we had bet. Kidnapped. Stolen. From the hospital nursery. How's that for taking the last that a man's got to live for? Oh, that's a bad deal, I agreed. Let's pour you another. No clues? Nothing the police could trace. Somebody came to see her, claimed to be her uncle. When the nurse had her back turned, he walked out with her. Description? Just a man with a face-shaped face, like yours or mine. I think it was the baby's father. The nurse swore it was an older man, but he probably used makeup. Who else would swipe my baby? Childless women pull such stunts. But who ever heard of a guy doing it? Well, what happened to you then? 11 more months of that grim place and 3 operations. In 4 months, I started to grow a beard. Before I was out, I was shaving regularly and no longer doubted that I was male. I was staring down nurses' necklines. Well, I said, seems to me you came through okay. I mean, here you are, a normal man, making good money, no real troubles, and the life of a female is not an easy one. Yeah, a lot you know about it. So? Ever hear the expression, a ruined woman? Well, years ago, it doesn't mean much today. I was as ruined as a woman could be. I mean, that bum ruined me. I wasn't even any longer a woman, and I didn't know how to be a man. That takes getting used to, I suppose. You have no idea. I don't mean learning how to dress or not walking into the wrong restroom. I learned those in the hospital. But how could I live? What job could I get? I mean, hell, I couldn't even drive a car. I didn't know a trade. I couldn't do manual labor. Too much scar tissue. Too tender. I hated him for having ruined me for the wenches, too. But I didn't know how much until I tried to join the Space Corps instead. One look at my belly, and I was marked unfit for military service. The medical officer spent time on me just from curiosity. He had read about my case. So I changed my name. I come to New York. I got by as a fry cook, then rented a typewriter and set myself up as a public stenographer. What a laugh. In 4 months, I typed 4 letters in 1 manuscript. And the manuscript was for real-life tales and a waste of paper. But the goof was that I sold, which gave me an idea. I bought a stack of confession magazines and studied them. He looked cynical. Now you know how I get the authentic woman's angle on an unmarried mother's story, right? Though the only version I haven't sold, the true one. So, do I win the bottle? I pushed it toward him. I was upset myself, but there was work to do. I said, son, do you still want to lay hands on that so-and-so? His eyes lighted up a feral gleam. Hold it. You wouldn't kill him, he chuckled nastily. Try me. Take it easy. I know more about it than you think I do. I can help you. I know where he is. Where is he? Let go of my shirt, Sonny. Are you going to land in the alley and we'll tell the cops you fainted? I showed him the sap. He let go. Sorry. But where is he? He looked at me. And how do you know so much? All in good time. There are records. Hospital records. Orphanage records. Medical records. The matron of your orphanage was Mrs. Featheridge, right? She was followed by Mrs. Gruenstein. Yeah? Your name as a girl was Jane. Right? And you didn't tell me any of this. Right? I had him baffled and a bit scared. Yeah, right. What is this? Are you trying to make trouble for me? No, indeed. I have your welfare at heart. I can put this character in your lap. You do to him as you see fit, and I guarantee that you will get away with it. But I don't think that you'll kill him. You would be nuts to. And you aren't nuts. Not quite. He brushed it aside. Cut the noise. Where's he? I poured him a short one. He was drunk, but the anger was offsetting it. Not so fast. I do something for you. You do something for me. Yeah? Like what? You don't like your work. What would you say to high pay, steady work, unlimited expense account, your own boss in the job, and lots of variety and adventure? He stared. I'd say, get those damn reindeer off my roof. Shove it, Pop. There's no such job. Okay, put it this way. I hand him to you, you settle with him, and then you try my job. If it's not all that I claim, well, then I can't hold you. He was wavering. The last drink did it. Well, when do you deliver him? If it's a deal, right now. I nodded to my assistant to watch both ends, noted the time, 2300, started to duck through the gate under the bar when the jukebox blared out. When the jukebox blared out, I'm my own grandpa. The serviceman had orders to load it with Americana and classics, because I couldn't stomach the so-called music of 1970, but I hadn't known that tape was it. I called out, shut that off, give the customer his money back. I added, store him, back in a moment, and headed there, with my unmarried mother following. It was down the passage across from the John's, a steel door to which no one but my day manager and myself had the key. Inside was a door to an inner room to which only I had a key. We went there. He looked blearily around at the windowless walls. So? Where's he? Right away. I opened a case, the only thing in the room. It was a USFF Coordinates Transfers Field Kit, Series 1992 Mod 2. A beauty, no moving parts, 23 kilos fully charged and shaped to pass as a suitcase. I had adjusted it precisely earlier that day. All I had to do was shake out the metal net, which limits the transformation field. Which I did. What's that? He demanded. Time machine, I said, and tossed the net over us. Hey! He yelled and stepped back. There's a technique to this. The net has to be thrown so that the subject will instinctively step back onto the metal mesh. Then you close the net with both of you inside completely, else you might leave shoe soles behind, or a piece of foot, or scoop up a slice of floor, but that's all the skill it takes. Some agents con a subject into the net. I tell the truth and use that instant of utter astonishment to throw the switch, which I did. 10:30, 3rd of April, 1963, Cleveland, Ohio, Apex Building. Hey, he repeated, take this damn thing off. Oh, sorry, I apologized, and did so. Stuffed the net into the case, closed it. You said you wanted to find him, but you said there was a time machine. I pointed out a window. Does that look like November or New York? While he was gawking at the new buds in the spring weather, I opened the case, took out a packet of $100 bills, checked that the numbers and signatures were compatible with 1963. The Temporal Bureau doesn't care how much you spend, it costs nothing, but they don't like unnecessary anachronisms. Too many mistakes and a general court-martial will exile you for a year in a nasty period like, say, 1974 with its strict rationing and forced labor. I never make such mistakes. The money was okay. He turned around and said, what happened? He's here. Go outside and take him. Here's expense money. I shoved it at him and added, settle him, then I'll pick you up. $100 bills have a hypnotic effect on a person not used to them. He was thumbing them unbelievably as I eased into the hall, locked him out. The next jump was easy, a small shift in era. 7100. 10th of March, 1964, Cleveland, Apex Building. There was a notice under the door saying that my lease expired next week. Otherwise, the room looked as it had a moment before. Outside, trees were bare and snow threatened. I hurried, stopping only for contemporary money and a coat, hat, and topcoat I had left there when I leased the room. I hired a car, went to the hospital. It took 20 minutes to bore the nursery attendant to the point where I could swipe the baby without being noticed. We went back to the Apex building. The dial setting was more involved as the building did not yet exist in 1945, but I'd pre-calculated it. 0100, September 20th, 1945, Cleveland Skyview Motel. Field kit, baby, and I arrived in a motel outside town. Earlier, I had registered as Gregory Johnson, Warren, Ohio, so we arrived in a room with curtains closed, windows locked, and doors bolted, and the floor cleared to allow for waiver as the machine hunts. You can get a nasty bruise from a chair where it shouldn't be. Not the chair, of course, but backlash from the field. No trouble. Jane was sleeping soundly. I carried her out, put her in a grocery box in the seat of a car I had provided earlier, drove to the orphanage, put her on the steps, drove two blocks to a service station, this is the petroleum type, and then phoned the orphanage, drove back in time to see them taking the box inside, kept going and abandoned the car near the motel, walked to it, and jumped forward to the Apex building in 1963. 2200. April 24th, 1963, Cleveland, Apex Building. I had cut the time rather fine. Temporal accuracy depends on span, except on return to zero. If I had it right, Jane was discovering out in the park this balmy spring night that she wasn't quite as nice a girl as she thought she had been. I grabbed a taxi to the home of those skinflints, had the hacky wait around a corner while I lurked in shadows. Presently, I spotted them down the street, arms around each other. He took her up on the porch, made a long job of kissing her goodnight, longer than I thought. Then she went in, and he came down the walk, turned away. I slid into step and hooked an arm in his. "That's all, son," I announced quietly. "I'm back to pick you up." "You?" he gasped and caught his breath. "Yeah, me. And now you know who he is. And after you think it over, you're going to know who you are. And if you think real hard enough, you're going to figure out who the baby is and who I am." He didn't answer. He was badly shaken. It's a shock to have it prove to you that you cannot resist seducing yourself. I took him to the Apex building, and again we jumped. 2300, August 12th, 1985, Sub Rockies Base. I woke the duty sergeant, showed my ID, told the sergeant to bet my companion down with a happy pill and recruit him in the morning. The sergeant looked sour, but rank is rank. Regardless of era, he did what I said, thinking, no doubt, that the next time we met, he might be the colonel and I the sergeant, which can happen in our corps. "What name?" he asked. I wrote it out. He raised his eyebrows. "Like so, eh? You just do your job, Sergeant." I turned to my companion. "Son, your troubles are over. They're about to start the best job a man ever held, and you'll do well, I know." "That you will," agreed the sergeant. "Look at me, born in 1917, still around, still young, still enjoying life." I went back to the jump room and set everything on the pre-selected zero. 2301, November 1970, New York City, Pop's Place. I came out of the storeroom carrying a fifth of Drambuie to account for the minute that I had been gone. My assistant was arguing with a customer who had been playing "I'm My Own Grandpa." I said, "Oh, let him play it, then unplug it." I was tired. It's rough, but somebody must do it. And it's very hard to recruit anyone in those later years since the mistake of 1972. And can you think of a better source than to pick people all fouled up where they are and give them well-paid, interesting, although dangerous work in a necessary cause? Everybody knows now why the Fizzle War of 1963 fizzled. The bomb with New York's number on it didn't go off. 100 other things didn't go as planned, all arranged by the likes of me. But not the mistake of 72. That one is not our fault, and it can't be undone. There's no paradox to resolve. The thing either is or it isn't, now and forever. Amen. But there won't be another like it. An order dated 1992 takes precedence any year. I closed 5 minutes early, leaving a letter in the cash register telling my day manager that I was accepting his offer to buy me out to see my lawyer as I was leaving on a long vacation. The bureau might or might not pick up his payments, but they want things left tidy. I went to the room in the back of the storeroom and forward to 1993. 2200. January 12th, 1993, Sub Rockies Annex, Headquarters Temporal, DOL. I checked in with that duty officer and went to my quarters, intending to sleep for a week. I had fetched the bottle we bet. After all, I won it, and took a drink before I wrote my report. It tasted foul, and I wonder why I had ever liked old underwear. But it was better than nothing. I don't like to be cold sober. I think too much. Don't really hit the bottle either. Other people have snakes. I have people. I dictated my report. 40 recruitments, all okayed by the Psych Bureau, counting my own, which I knew would be okayed. I was here, wasn't I? Then I tapped a requestment for assignment to operations. I was sick of recruiting. I dropped both in the slot and headed for bed. My eye fell on the bylaws of time over my bed. Never do yesterday what should be done tomorrow. If at last you do succeed, never try again. A stitch in time saves 9 billion. A paradox may be paradoctored. It is earlier than you think. Ancestors are just people, and even Jove nods. They didn't inspire me the way they had when I was a recruit. 30 subjective years of time jumping wears you down. I undressed, and when I got to the hide, I looked at my belly. A cesarean leaves a big scar, but I'm so hairy that I don't notice it unless I look for it. Then I glance at the ring on my finger. The snake that eats its own tail forever and ever. I know where I come from. But where did all you zombies come from? I felt a headache coming on, but a headache powder is one thing I do not take. I did once, and you all go away. So I crawled into bed and whistled out the light. You really aren't here at all. There isn't anybody but me, Jane, here alone in the dark. I miss you dreadfully. All You Zombies by Robert Heinlein. Here,
this next
over WBAI in New York.
Over on the Jerry Springer Show. I woke.
Well, this is mistake number two. I thought I had edited this to get rid of that long, long intro. And nope. We have to go forward. A perfect segue ruined. But here we are anyway.
Many years ago, when I was 23, I was married to a widow who was pretty as can be. The widow had a grown-up daughter who had hair of red. My father fell in love with her, and soon the two were wed. That made my dad my son-in-law, and it changed my very life. My daughter was my mother, 'cause she was my father's wife. Complicates the matter, even though it brought me joy. I soon became the father of a bouncing baby boy. I'm my own grandpa. Let's hear you singing. I'm my own grandpa. Sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. I'm my own grandpa. My baby boy, he then became a brother-in-law to Dad. So he was my uncle, and that made me.
Well, Well, that one wasn't my screw-up. I don't know what happened. All I know is I was trying to make an outgoing call, and the song went off. Okay, I'm going to ask that person, Terrence Taylor. I'm going to call him at home using my own phone. You know, bear with me a second, and we're going to have silence on the air for a moment while he and I confer. So bear with me. Hi there. So I don't know what the bleep is going on here. So I'm going to cut my mic. I'm going to give you a special number to call. Okay. Okay. Bye-bye. So while Terrence Taylor is calling in so we can discuss that story and things Whovian, let me again warn you all that if you have not watched the latest episode of Doctor Who and are planning on watching that, there he is. Okay, is that you, Terrence?
Yes.
Okay, very good, very good. So if you're planning on watching Doctor Who and don't want spoilers, tune out. This is going to be an all-spoilers show. All bets are off. So, Terrence, did you hear the story?
Yes, I did. I enjoyed that greatly, actually.
You can see how that's relevant to Who, don't you?
Well, it's also funny hearing it right after watching The Adjustment Bureau.
Mm.
So it's not time travel. The layering of manipulation of reality is sort of echoed there. So it was sort of a nice follow-up.
It really is. The other one is By His Bootstraps, also Heinlein, is the other great time travel one.
Uh-huh.
The Adjustment Bureau fits nicely. So did you end up liking it when last we spoke at about 11:30? The jury was out.
I was a little dubious. Yes, I actually did. It actually avoided most of the problems I have with those type of stories. The fact that inevitably it has to end in the couple getting together and having a happy romantic ending, unless of course you're Brazil, overrules everything else, but it worked nicely. And I don't know, there was just a whole sort of, pleasant sort of new agey undertone to the whole thing, that there is a plan, but we do have a certain amount of freedom to work within it.
Yeah, but it also is that Whovian, Torchwoodian kind of thing, that there are aliens, but in this case they are, I wouldn't say exactly benevolent, but they're not malevolent.
Well, they're bureaucratic, which I think bounces between the two. You never quite know with bureaucracy.
Yeah, well, I mean, that, of course, is pure dick.
Yes, yes.
In just so many ways. It's not a bad movie. As far as adaptations of Philip K. Dick are concerned, I thought that one worked fairly well.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, it's more Dick than some of the adaptations. It didn't go as far afield in terms of tone. I particularly like the guy from Mad Men. I can never think of the actor's name. But there was just this wonderful kind of bureaucratic kind of bluster with him that I just appreciated a lot somehow. That immediately, as soon as he realized he was wrong, he sort of backs down and apologizes and sort of moves forward to fix it all again. There was a wonderful whimsy to it that there isn't in most of the Dick adaptations, which tend to get kind of malign and dark.
Yeah, which is actually very Dick-esque.
Or
Dickian or whatever. It's Dickensian, so I guess it's Dickian. Or is it Dick-esque?
Well, yeah. Dickian. I guess it would be Dickian.
Dickian, yeah. Dickian, yeah. So that malevolent whimsy.
Yeah,
you know, especially when the story's written mid-50s
and
all that, you know, in the Digest magazines, it really has that feel to it.
Mm, mm.
But what Heinlein manages between this and By His Bootstraps and the story, and he built a crooked house, mm-hmm. or just he built a crooked house, I have to reread that one, mm-hmm. are just so... The way it interweaves time so well, and especially the idea that you have so many characters who turn out to be just one person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's funny because we had talked about David Gerrold's man who fondled himself, as you call it. He really actually did follow the Heinlein story in terms of those layers of, I mean, ultimately the character in the man who I call you the man who felt himself, folded himself, you know, does change gender at some point in that there's a sort of parallel universe where he's female and they both impregnate her, they both steal the baby of different genders and run off. The only thing he adds to it, really, to a certain degree, is the homosexual continuous orgy just running for a while as the guy is testing out the parameters of what he can and can't do with time travel and incestuous masturbation.
Yeah, I mean, that's where Heinlein drew the line, of course.
Which is actually kind of amazing with Heinlein. Well, I guess the gay aspect of it. But even I seem to be... I read Heinlein mostly, I think, in my sort of puberty. You know, like that 11, 12, 13 age, and I was... The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and but the novels that were very sexual at the time, for me, it was like, wow, you know, I was, like, sort of stunned at what he was covering.
But they're very sexual, but they're also extremely hetero.
Heterosexual, yeah.
And the women may be...
Including incest, but not quite crossing the line to incest.
And the women may be very, very smart, but they're also all breeding machines.
Well, you want a smart breeding machine, don't you?
Yeah, but, you know, with certain proportions. I mean, what's her name in Moon is a Harsh Mistress and all that is the absolute... Alexei Panshin in Heinlein and Dimension points out there's only really five Heinlein characters, mm-hmm. and they appear over and over again throughout the books, and I think that's absolutely true. I haven't read, by the way, the new Heinlein biography, Part 1, which came out earlier this year, and I think did not end up winning the Hugo, did it, for Best Nonfiction. I think, actually, Chicks Dig Time Lords.
Did it?
Oh, that definitely won the Hugo.
See, I haven't gone and looked at the listings yet. I've been, like, going nuts the last week.
Yeah, Chicks Dig Time Lords, which I may point out made its radio debut on this program.
Yes,
I had five of the people, including the editor by phone, on this program.
And I remember the lovely night at Blue Stocking. I mean, it was quite a fun book, yeah. Well, great, lovely. I'll just set off congratulations to all the ladies I knew who were involved.
Yeah. And I thought that was cool, only I was a little annoyed that it restricted itself to the chicks.
Yeah, well, it opened the door, though, to chaps who love Time Lords and all the various permutations, you know. I'm sure we could get a gay publication, a multiracial publication. You know, we can milk that damn, you know, time. Oddly enough, what a smooth transition into the topic of the evening.
Exactly.
He's clever. You've done this before, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. So, you know, speaking of which, I mean, in some ways, the story I read had almost more to do with the Pandoricum.
Yes.
That the final episode of last season, which I have to say, and I, you know, I know this will be controversial, I loved.
I have been, yeah.
Now let me say this.
Now, that was just the wedding episode specifically?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, let me say this outright.
Uh-huh.
Stephen Moffat is a wuss.
And but it's you for mean that in the best possible way.
It's for absolutely, that absolutely. Reason that I love what he writes.
Yes,
I mean, not
absolutely.
The very end of Jekyll, but the...
Which I haven't seen yet. I've only seen, like, the first two. I actually had to go back to Jekyll because the first two was sort of... It was feeling like pie halfway through.
The first two are warm-ups.
Well, that's why I have to keep going.
Jekyll really... The conspiracy thing never pays off. But where Jekyll really pays off is in episodes 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because in episode 3 is where Mrs. Jackman, Mrs. Jekyll, Gina Bellman, finds out who her husband is. And is she in jeopardy? This is Stephen Moffat. No, he's in jeopardy.
Ooh.
Oh, well. Yeah. You got to keep going with Jekyll.
Well, I'll keep going. It's in my Netflix stack. I also am eagerly awaiting the fourth episode of Sherlock, which 13 was pledging around. I went back to do my day job at 13.
They haven't even finished producing it yet.
And no, I'm sure not. That's why I'm eagerly awaiting. And they had actually pledged on, I guess, Masterpiece. They had run the first two, I think, only.
First three?
Well, I don't know if they even got to the third one. I don't know. Maybe Christian hasn't seen it yet. But I was horribly upset when I found out that I was given two programs that did not include that on my plate. I would love to have written the
we have to explain that for that you work for Channel 13 writing pledge breaks.
My alter ego, my Clark Kent identity, is writing and producing fundraising at public television, which is great fun in the digital age.
If Clark Kent were a gay black vampire writer, then that would be you, Terrence. Jesus.
Well, you know, I'm sure in some DC universe at some point he will be. I mean, they've...
That's right, the next reboot.
Every other permutation on Superman.
The next reboot.
There we go, there we go. It's not the only thing left they haven't done to him. So he did end up black in the Death of Superman series when they fragmented him into all the various people taking over his duties. So there was a black Superman at one point, but though he certainly would have appealed to us gays, he certainly was not, sadly enough, but... But give it time. Give it time. We have a Latin black Spider-Man. We'll get a gay black Superman at some point.
Yeah.
So the gay porn jokes are just inevitable. So.
But getting back, yeah, Man of Steel. But yeah. Getting back. Well, and of course, it's the classic story, Man of Steel, Woman of Kleenex, by Larry Niven. Which today people might consider dated. But when Niven wrote that in the early 70s, it was hilarious and amazing. Not to mention, you know, it starts getting into the details of, okay, let's say that Lois and Clark can generate a baby, you know, not to mention the sexual problem. Yeah, how to do that. First of all, you have to expose the spermatozoa to red kryptonite.
Which opens the door to a lot of interesting possibilities.
I mean, what if it turns out to be the wrong kind of kryptonite?
Well, there you go.
I mean, just it's a hilarious story, but it really helps to take yourself back to the 70s to read it. Just like the story I read, it really helps to take you to the 40s to appreciate humor about the service stations and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Why, and, of course, the far-flung wild future of 1963.
I love the description of 1974 with the rations and forced labor.
Yeah.
It wasn't that far off, actually.
No. You're quite predictive.
Yeah.
But getting back to Who, I mean, what Moffat does, especially starting with... okay, let me backtrack a little. Okay. The thing is that one thing you can be sure of when I say that Moffat is a wuss...
Okay.
Is that there are going to be a number of happy endings.
Favorite
characters who are killed in the Russell T. Davies world, they're dead.
Yes.
You know, in the Stephen Moffat world, being dead simply means you're out of the next episode.
It's like a soap opera world.
I mean, how many times did Rory die last season?
Well, and aren't we glad he kept bringing him back? Although there's still a question of that whole Roman soldier thing, because he seems to have the memories of a million-year-old or thousands-of-year-old android that was in his image that by the end of the Pandorica and the undoing of all that. But there's a lot of weird little problems with that as well. I mean, technically speaking...
But you see, that universe
is undone. The Earth is destroyed 20 times over.
The universe, the whole universe.
Amy even gets born. I mean, you know, so it's... So there's a few issues around the Pandora camp. But again, you know, it's the whole conundrum of paradoxes. And as we just heard in the story, paradoxes can be paradoxed. So.
Exactly. Yeah, that's such a wonderful phrase. I'm amazed.
I wrote that down. I, what I did do a sampler or a T-shirt. I just think that is one of the most brilliant expressions about time travel yet. That is just beautiful. For
and if you put a capital D on it.
Well, it identifies who's doing it. Well, to get back to the doctor, okay, so the last episode you're describing, the wedding episode.
Yes.
I have to describe to you how I watched this episode. I was getting on a plane to go to Boulder, Colorado, because a friend of mine had a terrible incident. She'd had an aneurysm. She had miraculously recovered to within 80% of full capacity and was about to fly back to Singapore, so I went out to visit her before she did. And I was going to be flying out Thursday or Friday, and I was going to miss that episode on Saturday, and I had no idea what I was going to have at the motel in Boulder, no idea what I'd be doing at that hour, and having seen the episode before, desperately wanted to see this episode. So I won't describe by what means I managed, but I managed to find a copy, which I was able to load onto my laptop with Portuguese subtitles, which was very distracting as you're trying to watch it. So I saved it. I didn't watch it in the airport. I get on the plane to go to Boulder, and I'm sitting between these two, like, college jocks who are going back to school, basically. These guys, these, like, you know, whoa, sort of guys in their early 20s and have been chatting with one about his career opportunities post-college and that sort of thing. So I'm sitting there, and once the flight gets underway, I start watching the episode. And I put in my earphones, and I'm watching it on the laptop full screen. And within, like, 15 minutes, I'm like weeping. I'm like just weeping throughout the episode for like 45 minutes. I'm like, oh, and I'm just sitting there, and they're like sort of glancing over, trying not to like to ignore this middle-aged black man who's sobbing at a science fiction show playing on his laptop screen, because, I mean, the imagery is God knows what the hell's going on. If they have any respect as male Americans of their age in this age, they would know damn well who the doctor was. But I completely agree. He is completely the wussy that I am. I mean,
it's the whole last season from beginning through end is nothing but a complete utter romantic comedy, with all a screwball romantic comedy with all of the trademarks.
Yeah.
And even the little things like leaving poor Amelia Pond, you know, waiting with a suitcase, and it's how many years until she turns up in that adorable little mini.
Oh my God.
But
yes.
They even take care
of
going back 12 episodes later, and this is what gets me.
To give her a best friend who turns out to be her daughter.
Yeah.
I mean, I nearly plopped when they fought. Because I'm sitting here watching this Unreal, and this is obviously where the spoiler section of the program begins. I'm sitting here watching this Unreal, and I'm looking at it, and I'm going, who is this young girl? I'm loving it. First of all, because she's like the you know, sassy black girl with a gun. You know, you not love her. You know, she pops in and immediately she's like.
And apparently, by the way, the actress is a very popular character from EastEnders.
Ah, well, that makes sense. She pops in like you would know who she is. You know, which is great.
In England, she's a star. Yeah,
that's a perfect guest star turn.
She ought to be a star here. She was wonderful. Yeah,
that makes sense. She was great. And I had problems actually with I can't remember the name of the episode. The Tenet episode where the tour bus gets lost in another dimension, and there's the sassy girl in black leather.
Is that Planet of the Dead or the Waters of Mars?
Planet of the Dead.
Planet of the Dead.
And we'd had a discussion, because you liked her more than I did.
Which stars the psychiatrist from Jekyll, but never mind that.
Oh, is that who she
is? The woman, that woman in black, wearing all that latex, who in the U.S. was very briefly a rebooted $6 million woman. That's her, and that's her. She's the nurse who takes care of Jekyll.
Oh, I'll keep an eye out.
Yeah, that's her.
You know, the $6 million woman reboot, I never saw it. I caught at least the first two or three, because I love the $6 million. I love Jamie. I mean, it was Lindsay Wagner. She really did. It's one of those points in time where an actor gets a part that could be just such crap. but somehow the performer carries it off. If Bosom Buddies did that, I mean, that could have been the worst sitcom ever written, but Tom Hanks and I feel terrible for that.
Peter Scolari,
who were wonderful. They turned it into something absolutely beyond the capacity of the premise, and it became a wonderfully witty comedy with two incredibly intelligent actors who could pull off the material about being of that age and at a professional in New York and struggling, and the drag aspect really dropped into the background. I mean, it became a...
Although, you know, there's another show coming out this season with exactly that premise, the whole drag thing.
Now, what was it?
I don't know. It sounds, you know, they're in an all-girl band, you know, so it's ripping a little bit from Billy Wilder.
Well,
you know,
it's, I mean, Bosom Buddies was taking but why, like a hot
but
as well.
But why today? Why with today's sensibilities are they doing that?
God knows. Desperation.
It's either desperation or it's Fox.
What?
It's either desperation or else it's Fox.
Well, yeah. Sure, like, that's anonymous. Well, you know, I question so many things of what happened now. I mean, there's so many retreads of things that at some point in time someone liked sufficiently for us to be able to remember it, but not so well that the rights cost a lot. I mean, the whole Del Toro reboot of Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, I kept looking at the posters in the subway, and it was saying, based on the teleplay such and such. I'm like, well, what teleplay? What the heck is this? So I Google it. I love Google. You know, you can just, the modern age, there is no trivia anymore. You can find out anything. And I'd completely forgotten the Kim Darby TV movie. And deservedly. I mean, it's not a great beloved. It's nothing like the Karen Black, you know, They Live or They Stalk or They Bite or whatever the heck it was, the little voodoo doll thing that she unties, the African devil doll that chases her to the house with a knife, and that was wonderful. That was classic. This was not. This was one of those really cheesy, made-for-TV horror things. And it's being rebooted with CGI, you know, and it's like, really?
It cheapens it.
So many remakes of things. That just the desperation, the fear of doing anything original at this point, because they refuse to do anything that doesn't cost $100 million, is getting more and more restrictive in terms of what you get to see. So in that universe, get back to Doctor Who. Thank God for Doctor Who. I mean, I love the BBC for realizing they've got some money coming in and they should just keep doing this infinitely. I just don't ever want them to stop.
By the way, Michelle Ryan was the actress. Speaking of Google, it was Michelle Ryan.
Okay. Well, I've got to go back to Jekyll and see more of that. But the thing is that they managed to, like, just get me back to the tear stage again with this last episode, because at the point, first of all, you're right about the romantic comedy. I so love the point where she's regenerated, she's River Song, she has no freaking idea who she is in relation to any of them, except that she knows that she's Rory and Amy's daughter.
Yeah, but, now you and I and Barbara were all discussing this when we went to see Peter and Wendy.
We've been talking about this for months, about where this was going.
Yeah, and this was before we saw the first half of this season.
Yeah.
So, but we knew that it was all about River Song.
Right.
And we just had different ideas. I had the idea, and who knows? We all knew that River Song was a Time Lord. There was no question about that.
Yeah.
But my idea, of course, was actually very Heinlein, which was that River Song is a future version of the Doctor.
Yeah.
She's like the 18th Doctor or something like that.
Which would have been fun. I mean, I would love them to do a woman Doctor at some point. There was talk at some point before Matt that they were going to bring in Absolutely Fabulous, Jennifer.
Oh, that was never true.
I know, but the concept was
and the reason, but you know, and she's already done it anyway.
Yes, well,
in the Curse of the Fatal Death.
Well, no, but that was Patsy. I wanted Dina. It was a Dina.
Oh, I'm sorry. By the way, you know that they've revived. Are you ready? BBC America has commissioned 3 90-minute episodes of Ab Fab. Sorry, I shouldn't have.
I know.
Gay America is now swooning.
I know, you've just made the gay part of me so terribly happy right now. especially them at this age. I mean, my God, can only imagine what they've turned into. And poor Safi. I mean, you know, it's like there was some reunion movie thing they did at some point. And for some strange reason, why do I think They did something peculiar. They didn't recast Safi in it, did they?
By the way, just looking at Michelle Ryan's IMDb, upcoming film is called Cockneys versus Zombies.
Jeez. I am so tired of zombies already.
I'm at the title. Oh, my God. The title, Cockneys versus Zombies. You know, EastEnders, zombies and EastEnders.
It's, as long as there's subtitles. It's like, I've been watching Misfits on Hulu, and it's like, a friend of mine's daughter turned me on to it, and it's like, it's really fun. It's a little much with the teen angst, but it's still, it's imaginative and interesting, but some of the, it's like, I need the subtitles up. It's like, I have no idea what happened.
And so it's one of the reasons why, although I watch the BBC One version, or rather BBC HD version of Doctor Who, and some other shows, I will record it at the same time on BBC America.
Right.
So that if needs be, and this is something I'm going to have to do with Let's Kill Hitler, which was the latest Doctor Who episode, I'm going just to catch all the references and to hear some of the things they were talking about. Now, one friend of mine who will go nameless, by the way, told me this evening that she outgeeked me.
Yeah.
And oh my God, did she ever. What they were able to do is she knows somebody who has VPN access into London. You know, a VPN is a virtual private network.
Ooh.
It's a way, it's like having I'm a former network administrator, okay? So it's like having a LAN and being attached to that LAN.
Restrictions of America, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
So that means that you can actually watch the BBC iPlayer and watch it from the BBC site live during transmission. So I would boast that, you know, I have friends who, you know, I'm able to get a copy and I watch the show before it airs in the US. Well, this one watches it as it's aired in London.
God.
That outgeeks me, I must say.
there was, I remember in 91 when I moved to LA, there was something the phone company could do, which was, if you were in L.A., they could give you a 212 telephone. And it was as if the phone was in New York. You would pay the rates, if you made a call with it, to two blocks away from you in L.A., it would be long-distance rates to that other phone. But you could have a local call phone in another city. And I love the concept of that. I mean, that's sort of the same thing. It's like, you could have a computer that's actually in London. I mean, I love that. And you could just do everything you could do with a computer in London.
Yeah.
No, that's sweet. Yeah,
and that's actually not that new.
No.
VPN goes back a while. But anyway, getting back to Who, the thing that they have become masterful at, something that Stephen Moffat really knows, is the misdirected cliffhanger.
Yeah.
He does it during his first season last year with the Matt Smith with Amy, where after one episode, at the end of the episode, Amy decides, well, gee, I'm bored. I'm going to jump the Doctor for entertainment. And at the end of the episode, she plants a huge kiss on him. And he takes her and he thrusts her into the TARDIS. And the blogosphere and the Twitter world and everybody is going absolutely nuts. Because now all they can think of is the Doctor has bedded Amy. This is the ultimate no-no. And of course you tune in and everybody for a week they're going on, and it turns out, of course, that all he was doing was shoving her in there so he could take her to her boyfriend.
Right.
But it was the cliffhanger. It was the way that they managed to do it and totally misdirect you. So now we have the cliffhanger at the end of the first half of this series that, you know, the Doctor goes to war, which has its good points and its bad points and all that. But what do they do? they give you the answer to one of the main storylines, that River is actually, you know, that
Amy
Melody is
daughter.
Actually River, and it's Amy and Rory's daughter who has TARDIS-like capabilities, Time Lord capabilities, because she was conceived, theoretically, on the TARDIS. Now, there are actually issues with that when you think about it.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of things. And then they let loose that the next episode is going to be called Let's Kill Hitler. And what do they show in the coming attractions but Hitler looking at Amy, Rory, and the Doctor saying, "You have saved my life." And once again, the blogosphere and all these people are running around saying, "Oh my God, we're going to have a Hitler episode just like they had a Churchill episode." And it's all going to be about that thing, and how could the Doctor save Hitler? And by the way, isn't that one? You know, they don't even bother with the Doctor, Doctor mythology, that killing Hitler is a fixed point in time.
Right.
And all that. And guess what? When they finally get around to an episode called Let's Kill Hitler, it turns out that covers the first 10 minutes. It's got
nothing to do with anything going on in the episode.
Got nothing to do with Hitler. It's got nothing to do with changing time. And even then, there's a gag, which is probably a throwaway gag, where they say, well, you know, you can do anything with fixed points of time. What about Kennedy?
Yeah.
They never bothered to explain that. Now, it could be a throwaway joke. But what year is it that the Doctor dies in Utah?
I was 60-something. I'd have to look it up.
It's April. I remember that. But at any rate, I think he dies in the 70s, but they have to go to the 60s to find the silence and figure it all out.
Right, and the silence evidently isn't quite gone yet.
Oh, God, no. If they had
that
been, they would...
wrapped up awfully quickly in that, you know, lunar episode, and then...
That's why they go to the 60s, because they...
still behind all this
because they ex-
the
because they ex- they
he
exposes them on the moon,
right, and in effect on Earth, but not throughout the universe, one presumes.
I thought then, and we'll see how it wraps up, that the silence is an awfully poor villain. If they are always there, you know, this huge conspiracy larger than the universe, and they're vanquished by showing them on TV.
And just getting people to kill them every time they see them.
Yeah, it
also, it's awfully messy, doesn't it? I mean, once you've killed them, they're sort of there, aren't they? You've got a body laying about.
And now we find out that they are a religious order.
Now, that, though, seems to tie them to the headless monks, doesn't it? Because that was another sort of a religious order-y kind of a thing.
Yes, it was, and they never fully explained it.
No. So, I mean, the headless monks and the silence seem to somehow have some sort of affinity or connection.
So I'm not sure that we're done with all that.
Order.
You know, we know that River is going to turn into whatever species or type of person, that woman with the eye patches. We know that because we've seen the coming attraction.
Oh, wait a minute, I haven't seen the coming attraction. Wait, River? Well, the last I saw...
Now, this isn't in the show. This is a coming attraction.
Well, no. I haven't seen those yet. I don't watch BBC America unless I'm watching The Doctor, you know, or Torchwood when it was on. But so the last thing I saw was a little capper at the end of the episode where River is basically applying to archaeology school so she can find a good man. So there's another trailer post that. I mean, that wasn't a trailer; it was just a tag of the show. So there's a trailer that implies that River becomes the woman with the eye patch?
No, not that, but we see her and she's got that patch on, and she's acting evil.
Oh, so maybe Mendel's transfer or something.
Well, and that, by the way, that trailer predates Let's Kill Hitler. That trailer was at the end
of last season.
Well, the half season.
Huh.
It was after A Good Man Goes to War, and they showed coming attractions of the second half.
Well,
and we saw Hitler. We saw River wearing that eye patch. And by the way, we saw Churchill.
And they cut
from Hitler to Churchill. So we may not be done with World War II.
Well, we also may not be done with the Daleks. Because you'll remember at the end of the Churchill Dalek episode, the Daleks have been basically rebooted into like the new Super Daleks who wipe out the old Daleks and take off before the Doctor can really do anything about them. And that sort of vanished.
Well, we're going to see Cybermen next episode. We're going to see Cybermen.
Yeah, and I think we've got the Daleks coming back, too, because they're not done. I, you know, they're all like glossy Miata colors now, and I think they're tying in. If we're seeing Churchill, we may be going back to that time period. Though God knows they could pop up anywhere. Well, the other thing, something is just my little pointed head about that, but I've lost it now because the Dalek thing distracted me. The other thing we haven't also wrapped up yet is the actual death of the Doctor. I mean, we've seen a death of the Doctor.
Oh, well, I mean,
the Doctor's death, but we still have to get to that point in time and establish who's actually. I mean, bottom line is River was in prison forever for killing the Doctor.
Well, we don't know about forever.
Well,
a long, long time.
A long time. Essentially, she bopped in and out for dates with the Doctor.
But River is a time lord.
Well, she's a time lord with no more regenerations, though. She's a clever, clever time lord. She's able to get.
But we don't know. Yeah, she gave up the rest. We weren't told how many. We don't know how many.
The Bible is 13. And they danced that with the Doctor.
They've already
violated that with the Master.
They violated that 9 times. And by the way, we don't know. Yes, she gave up the last of her regenerations to unkill the Doctor.
Right.
But we don't know. How many was it? Was that 2? Was it 13? Was that 8?
Well, true. We don't know the
we don't know how many lives.
We don't know which regeneration that was.
Yeah, we don't know how many lives there were before Mel.
Well, we saw her as a little girl, that little girl who at the end of an episode suddenly throws her arms up and starts regenerating.
But we don't know into who. How do we know that she regenerates into Mel?
Absolutely. Absolutely. She could have been 5 incarnations before Mel.
That's right.
So we have no idea. But the thing is, what we do know is we have not yet seen River Song kill the Doctor. We've seen her poison him to the point of death and then save him, but the crime for which she was jailed, we have either witnessed with the astronaut moment, but we still can't. The question I have, and here's the question that is yet to be resolved, is what is the actual killing of the Doctor for which she has been incarcerated? We've seen the Doctor die with her standing behind, witnessing it with Rory and Amy, where someone in an astronaut suit kills the Doctor. They then burn him in pyre, and they push him off to sea, and they're acting as if he's really dead, and they've got an earlier incarnation who then buries them through the rest of the season.
And by the way, I'm still guessing, but I could very well be wrong, that that in that astronaut suit is the little girl.
Well, it's either the little girl.
Who's been calling Nixon. Don't forget that.
Yes, and we know that at a certain point, the little girl in the spacesuit is an agent of evil or whatever. And that absolutely she could have been popped into that place and point in time to kill the Doctor. Now the question is, was that the real Doctor or a living flesh Doctor? Because that's sort of been seeded that could be.
And well, obviously there are multiple Doctors right there. They're 200 years apart from each other.
But the reality is, and here's my argument. Well, not my argument, but here's the thing: Matt is not going to be the last Doctor. Matt is not the last actor who will ever play the Doctor. Matt is directly connected to the last Doctor incarnation of David Tennant, coming into him being Matt. Matt is going to be recast several times in future generations ad infinitum for as long as the human race and a willingness to put on Doctor Who, which as long as we're watching it making money will be forever.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, even if that Doctor dies and is burned to ash and never more exists, he's not the last Doctor. We know that is not the death of the Doctor.
Right.
There is a death we don't know the nature of it yet. And that's the mystery that's keeping me watching to figure out where he's going with that.
And we and for all we know, that doctor could be the Flesh.
Absolutely. Or not River, but some other incarnation. It could be anyone.
Exactly. I mean, there are two. It could be, here's a thought. It could be that Tesser thingy poo. What was it called?
The Tesseract?
Remember the people in that robot, the tiny little people?
Yes, I will. Well, yeah. They're still bouncing around, aren't they?
Yeah,
well,
and who are they?
The hell was that
are they
about?
Time
yes.
agents?
I
are they?
Know.
Are they?
What the hell was that?
They're
all
some
about?
Kind of Justice Department from a far, far future,
which has nothing to do with the time. Lord.
Yeah, but who knows?
And we're traveling through time with technology.
But this could answer another question,
which would be
explaining the origin
of the Time Lord.
Of another Stephen Moffat character. The first character that Stephen Moffat introduced to Doctor Who.
The Doctor's daughter?
No. That's not Stephen Moffat.
Oh, right. Okay. No. Okay.
Empty Child episode. Oh, Terrence, you're disappointing
Jack?
Me.
Jack?
Of course, Jack. Captain Jack Harkness,
okay,
time agent from the far future.
And the white-haired Spike, who is the other time agent.
We know his arc as the face of Bo, but what's his beginning?
We know
how he took on the name Jack Harkness.
Yes, and we also know he was a time agent because that gets established in many episodes, including the one with the actor who played Spike and Angel. Who
James Marsters.
James Marsters, who I can't remember the character's name, but who was another time agent who had the same little bracelet thing that Jack had.
I think his name was Cox.
Who had a history with him, and the whole issue with his brother, that whole season in Torchwood, they were dealing with Jack's brother coming back and being evil and having to be tossed into the deep freeze. I wonder what happened to him when Torchwood got destroyed. There's another little strand that they may pick up, because we know where that panel went from the new Torchwood. But at any rate, yes, absolutely. You're right. I mean, this is what he used to work for.
So there could be a time. And by the way, if they were to do another spinoff,
that would be a reverse one.
Having those guys inside that body with the jellyfish and all that.
Yeah.
That alone could be another show.
Yeah. Though, well, it would be in conjunction with agents like Jack and the Hark and the
well, exactly, character, exactly,
who are running around with the bracelets as opposed to being in the bodysuits that can pretty much solve virtually any problem unless they get shot in the wrong point of the body to break things down.
Yeah.
I did love the racing to the eye, the little broadcast news moment where she's trying desperately to get to the right place and right time to do the things she has to do.
That was very well done. And by the way, I loved the morphing instead of the usual bad morphing software.
No, that was well done. The little flipping tiles, yeah.
Well, you know what? We're actually already out of time.
I was just looking at the clock, ironically enough, I might say.
Yeah, and I'm a little confused because Lister has not walked into the studio. Usually he comes in about half an hour before the end of the show. I do not know what is coming on from 3 to 5 a.m. this morning.
Oh.
I presume that somebody out there is going to walk in. Otherwise, you and I could be on for another 2 hours.
It's not like we're not capable. And it may be, excuse me.
Gazunt!
Oh, my God. I've got the fan going in. Oh, excuse me. Evidently, something is happening. Maybe it's time ripples.
Okay, no, maybe it is time ripples. You got to watch out. They will make you sneeze.
Yeah, I'm obviously allergic to...
Okay, well, Terrence, let's assume that at this point we have to go off.
Okay, well, indeed. Wrap yourself up and as you need.
Tell people what books you have in print.
Oh, my God. Well, Bite Marks and Blood Pressure, both still delightfully available on Amazon and many other bookstores near you. While I work on my third, which is something else entirely, and go to doyoubelieveinvampires.com to read about those and see lovely clips of me chatting and many other fun things.
Very good. So thank you, Terrence.
Thank you.
And if it turns out we're not off the air, I'll call you back.
Okay, I'll go online and hear what happens.
Okay, take care.
It's like a mystery I can't escape.
There you go.
Bye.
Bye. And, well, to all of you, although no show has shown up, although there's only 90 seconds left to our next show, let me tell you that you've been listening to Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be on next week with other geeky thingies, mostly science fiction fantasy, from 1:30 to 3. Visit me at ourwolf.com. Follow the Twitter. Go to Facebook. Google Plus, great place to find me. All those kinds of things. In the meantime, stay tuned to WBAI. And, well, maybe I'll be here in 1 minute, or maybe somebody else. At any rate, have a wonderful week. Well, we're still here. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Usually at this time, Burn Baby Burn Clappers is on the air with Lister. But he's not here. Tony, are you... busy working on the Al Jazeera broadcast? I guess you are, but if you could come in here for a moment, since you are the ops person on duty, I would appreciate it so we can discuss what is to come next. I mean, I can go on till 5 a.m. I've got absolutely no problem with that. I would love to continue this topic, put Terrence Taylor back on the phone, and start taking phone calls. I see some people out there, but I have no idea what they are doing. If you are listening, if you are here to do your show, let me inform you that it is getting on to 3:02 in the morning. I signed off, but I'm still here. Why don't I put on, if I can bring it up, unfortunately, that playlist has disappeared, or I would play. I've got that specific promo in mind. Well, we've got another promo machine over here. So let me put on a piece of music. Well, it's you, is it?
It more certainly is.
My God, it feels like old times, but reversed.
Yes, it's you.
Hobte. It is a long freaking time. It is a great thing to see you, even if you're like, 2 minutes late?
No.
What do you mean? It's 3:02, you know. I haven't seen you.
I'm coming in now.
Well, I used to follow you. Yes. So are you subbing for Lister?
I'm subbing for Lister.
Ah, that explains it.
I'm subbing for Lister, so.
Well, this is a good thing. As much as I like... By the way, having Lister, I really miss following you. I really, really, really miss that transition.
Look here. It is missed too, you know, because we dug the...
That was a good lineup for...
A great...
Well, you were only there for like 12 years or so. You were a newbie, right? Yeah. Before that, you had a midnight slot.
Yes, yeah.
And then they put you in 3 a.m. as a Siberia of some kind. Bernard Siberia.
I understand that too.
I don't.
No, I understand the move to Siberia. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I understand why.
Yeah, well.
And while I enjoyed following you, I never found the justification to be justified.
Well, not that I didn't. You know, it is not that there's agreement.
Get closer to on mic, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know.
Let's keep this conversation not only between the two of us. Hey, Tony.
Yeah. No, it's Well, I guess if it is like that, I need to put that over there.
What I need to do is to start disengaging my equipment here. If you want, I can put something on.
Oh, I would appreciate
it. Yeah, but and Lister and I are pretty loose.
But
you know why I pay attention to those times and stuff like that? It's not because of the airflow, because I think the airflow at this hour, I don't think the people at home are looking at their watches and saying, oh my God, it's 3:01. But the internet does.
Well, that I see, you know, and it's very prompt.
Yeah, the Internet Archive, if somebody is listening to this,
precisely,
in the future, it starts at, you know, starts at 1:30 sharp, at 3 o'clock sharp, and that ain't radio.
Well, that's precisely. Not community.
It's not radio. It's the internet. It's broadcasting. It's legitimate.
Yeah.
But it's not the flow for this hour.
Yeah. Because, as you say, in terms of that time, it begins promptly at 3. So although the conversation is going on, it is going on in.
Yeah.
Burn, baby, burn. So.
Yeah, and the flow may be going, and just as I would always have a lovely segue coming out from your program, Lister always has a lovely segue going. Going from Hour of the Wolf. I'm looking for a very specific promo that, of course, is a show that I'm doing.
Yes.
To play. So why don't I play that? Is 1 minute enough?
Oh, it should be.
Okay. Yeah, I will play that and vacate. And everybody, by all means, stay tuned for, what are you calling this slot?
Burn, Baby, Burn.
Burn, Baby, Burn, Clappers with Havde Selassie.
Yeah, and, I'm sitting in for Lister.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I promise you, if Lister were here, it would be a great show. With Hopte here, it'll still be a great show.
We sincerely hope so.
I guarantee it.
Okay.
I don't know about you. I guarantee it. Okay, everybody, stay tuned.
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes. Wednesday, 9:12:01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street.
On Sunday, September 11th, as part of WBAI's special anniversary programming, the next hour, with guest host Jim Freund, will feature this award-winning story, followed by an interview with Rick Bowes and the preeminent psychologist on contemporary terrorism, Dr. Charles B. Strozier. That's September 11th at 11 a.m. on the next hour, featuring Richard Bowes reading There's a Hole in the City.
Headquartered in the Middle East and brought to you by way of WBAI, Al Jazeera English provides you with a global view of current affairs and events every single day. Now, listen to Al Jazeera English twice a day, first at 5:30 a.m. and then at 6:30 p.m. Keep informed and stay tuned to Al Jazeera English, broadcast for you here on 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org.
As Labor Day approaches, 99.5 FM WBAI in New York will be presenting special carnival programming leading up to its live Labor Day coverage of the West Indian American Day Carnival Association's Parade of the Bands on Eastern Parkway. WBAI will be covering Whitaker's Kitty's Carnival on Saturday, September the 3rd. Then we'll switch to Charlie's Block Party on Fulton Street and Nostrand Avenue in Brooklyn. On Wednesdays, we'll be dedicating our 10 a.m. to noon music programming to Caribbean music. So stay tuned to 99.5 on your FM dial or log on to WBAI.org on your computer or smartphone for the best Caribbean programming in the New York tri-state area.
Starting Monday, June 6, Al Jazeera English can now be heard twice a day at 5:30 a.m. and at 6:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. Get your world news exclusively through WBAI. You can find Al Jazeera English on your FM dial 99.5 and on the web at WBAI.org. Stay tuned, stay informed.